Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Greetings and welcome to another episode of Canadian History X. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can. Just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX. You can support the podcast for as little as $3 a month, and every dollar you give helps keep the podcast going. When I was 6 years old, I was in grade one in Armstrong, British Columbia, and somebody came to our class and pulled me out of class and told me that I had a special job. I was going to give a check to somebody. I didn't know who this person was or the significance of what they were doing, but I suddenly found myself a few days later standing on a stage with hundreds of people around the stage, and a man in a wheelchair came up onto the stage. And I shook his hand, and I remember the feel of his glove, and I gave him a check. I didn't know at the time, but that man was named Rick Hansen. I don't know why I was giving him a check. I still don't, really. But it is one of the fondest memories of my youth. I even have a picture of it, and I'll put that picture up on the website. A few years ago, when I was in High River working as an editor, I talked to Rick Hansen again. And today, I have another interview with Rick Hansen, where we talk about the Rick Hansen Foundation, the Man in Motion Tour, his donation of several artifacts to the Canadian Museum of History, and much more. So, I'm just going to get right to it. Let's talk to a Canadian icon, a Canadian hero, and arguably one of the most famous Canadians in history, Rick Hansen. First question is, how have you been doing during the COVID outbreak?
You know, COVID kind of came out of the blue, and it was an interesting progression for the consciousness of not only ourselves, but the rest of our team. You know, you've sort of seen it at a distance in the news in China, and then all of a sudden it was in Europe. And before we knew it, you know, it was starting to happen in Canada. And it progressed in our minds from, you know, being concerned for others to eventually, oh my gosh, this is going to affect us, and we have to start to make adjustments. And, you know, that continual transition in terms of the ambiguity of your set points and perceptions and arming yourself with an ever-changing progression of facts and then being able to respond was super critical. And boy, it's been quite a journey. It's obviously challenged us to look at and face our fears, to be armed with knowledge and be responsible, and not just for our own health, but the health of others. And then to be able to still, as we manage through that, be optimistic, be driven by hope, by reframing to the things that mattered most, which is love, and to be able to find meaning and purpose and to take control of the things within this world that seems to become more and more out of control. And those notes give you a sense of resiliency and then just keep reframing to shorter time frames because mm-hmm. the situation was so dynamic and fluid. And so from a family point of view, while it's been challenging, it's also been you know, very meaningful, because I think it's also helped remind us that life is precious. It also makes us realize that every day counts, and And also, as long as we're connected, committed to doing work the best we can, and also be compassionate and loving within each other, our family unit, and within our community and the world, then we're doing our best to be able to help endure and weather this transition.
Absolutely. So how has the legacy of the Man in Motion Tour kind of grown or changed over the past 35 years?
You know, when I finished my Man in Motion Tour, and the driving force for doing it was, we were in a world, in an era, where people with disabilities were truly looked at as, in many ways, second-class citizens, definitely in terms of the structure of many of our laws and our attitudes and some of the systems and structures. And the perceptions really needed to change in my mind. I had to battle perceptions personally, because I was a young Canadian who was brought up in a bias when I thought of and looked at people with disabilities. And all I saw was disability, limitation, and I felt pity. I didn't understand, you know, the opportunities, the potential, the ability, and the importance of including people as equals, and then also understand all the barriers that were out there. And so when I had my accident at the age of 15, I was immersed into this world, had to make that transition. And then as I did, I started to accept myself as a whole human being with ability. I started to reframe, set goals, and chase dreams and live a full and meaningful life, but still encountered that social and real physical barriers and structures and resistance. And as I became a world champion and Paralympian and traveled the world, I realized that the barriers still existed, and I wanted to try to change that. And so by the time I finished the Man in Motion Tour, there was a lot of momentum here in Canada for sure, and pockets around the world were starting to shift and evolve. And I think that in the 35 years since that period, we've really seen a fundamental transformation. And what we found is that there's been a shift from a sense of charity and pity and bias and stigma to a sense of equality, a real belief that people with disabilities have ability, and that there's a commitment to remove barriers that don't have to be there to create an accessible and inclusive society. And that change also has been backed up by fundamental laws, legislation, whether it's the Americans with Disabilities Act in the United States, whether it's human rights legislation in China, or most recently even here in Canada, our accessibility for Canadians with Disabilities Act. And so these are fundamental levels of progression. And I think we're about to really enter the next phase, which is that we're going to see people with disabilities as a tremendous positive force for helping strengthen and build our culture and society, and the ability to contribute and to be full and meaningful citizens, and that diversity will strengthen us in a very significant way. And that's the exciting and optimistic part of the journey that we're still on in this ultra marathon of social change.
Looking back, we're 40 years since the Marathon of Hope, 35 years since the Man in Motion Tour. What's it like to kind of look back on those legacies and see their role in Canadian history and heritage a few decades later?
Well, from a personal point of view, it's really quite stunning to believe what's transpired since those early days when I was a young Paralympian, a wheelchair basketball player on the Vancouver Cable Cars team, and looking for a way to pay it forward with the team and looking for new recruits. And through a friend, I was introduced to Terry Fox, who had just lost his leg to cancer, and recruited him to participate and play on our wheelchair basketball team. We became great friends, and we were inspired and mentored by the incredible nature of this unique team in a moment in time. Tremendous athletes, a real passion for life, and really people who had transformed themselves from being disabled to being able. And it affected all of us. And probably the most important part for Carrie and I is that we were profoundly affected by our team manager, Stan Strong, who was one of the first surviving paraplegics. And he was injured in the 30s. And in spite of his profound disability, he actually refused to give up his view of himself and lose sight of the love and the meaning and purpose in life every day, in spite of the challenges he faced. And he was also motivated to pay it forward and give back. And so he was giving back to our team and inspiring us to think about our ability and our mission to contribute as well. And from that unique little wheelchair basketball team, inspired and helped generated by someone like Stan Strong, Carrie and I were motivated. We became friends. We challenged each other. We inspired each other. And eventually we pursued dreams that were relevant to us and our unique experiences. Carrie to help the pain and make it stop from the suffering and the death and the dramatic consequences of cancer. And me to help shift the attitudes and the environment of limitation for people with disabilities so that they could reach their full potential and maybe even find a cure for paralysis one day. And so that was all incubated in that moment in time. And how would we have known in that era what would have transpired as we just struggled every day to live up to that challenge and express ourselves?
Absolutely. What led you to decide to donate artifacts from the tour to the Museum of History?
You know, the Canadian Museum of History approached me and asked if I would consider donating artifacts that we had from the tour. And at first, I didn't really understand what the purpose might be and why. We had actually just been holding all this stuff in a storage area. And they said that they really believe that the tour and the incredible sense of power of community, all the people who worked to help me turn that dream into reality and to make a difference, was fundamentally embedded in the Canadian spirit. And that also that the dream that I was pursuing was still unfolding here in Canada and around the world. And they wanted this artifact collection and the story and the narrative of the Man in Motion World Tour to be about not just history, but also about a continuing journey to educate new Canadians, the next generation, to continue to do their part, because it was going to be a long, long journey to get to that end game. And that was the most inspiring part to me, is that the displays and the work would be taken over by the people of Canada through the Museum of History, that it would be framed in the context of the we, not me, and that it would be directed forward in the purpose of the original vision and mission, and the need for all of us to keep thinking about how we can get to that dream and turn it into a reality.
So shifting gears a bit to talk about the foundation, what led to the creation of the Rick Hansen Foundation?
Well, when you're young and, you know, you have a really kind of maybe an overly optimistic view of what would take to get to a goal or a dream. I thought that my contribution, first of all, would be as a volunteer for the 4 years, you know, the period to start up, the 2 years of the endeavor, and a year to wind down, and that we would have really made huge progress. I mean, as wonderful as the tour was, then it became pretty clear that it was just a baby step in a very, very big, big hill to climb. And not just one dream, but two big dreams, a cure for paralysis in a world that was accessible for people with disabilities who wouldn't be cured, that could live a full life. And we were very fortunate that we built a tremendous amount of partners and supporters and people who believed in us. We generated a $26 million fund that was part of the fundraising component of the tour. And we had to turn our direction towards the future. And it was clear that we would need not only a foundation to to ensure the oversight of, and the use of those funds, but that we could build off the momentum and the incredible energy of goodwill and my own personal leadership, and eventually see that transformed into long past my life, and that you needed a formal vehicle for that, and so therefore the foundation was created. And now, as I look back at this now 30 some odd years later, I'm no longer the founder and CEO of that foundation. I'm the founder of it, and I still play a very strong role in helping to elevate my time and attention to support the work of the foundation. But there's a board of directors, a CEO, and an incredible staff, and a bunch of volunteers and partners that keep working on solutions to accelerate progress nationally and globally. And I'm super inspired by the work they do. And I also know that, you know, we're built for the future, and I'm going to continue to help pursue that journey until the day I no longer can.
You kind of mentioned it, but what does the foundation do to provide for people who live with some sort of disability?
Yeah, the things that we do, obviously we continue to support leadership in developing a global network of collaborators in spinal cord research, because one day a cure for paralysis will take place. And people with disabilities also have spinal cord injury, and mm-hmm. and that's an important thrust that we really believe in. Secondly, is in the area of the 1.3 billion people who live with a disability today, according to the World Health Organization, and the world is growing exponentially because of aging baby boomers and their parents. People who have mobility challenges, sensory, hearing, visual, and other relevant disabilities, that we really believe that there's a tremendous requirement to keep changing attitudes, to make people aware that disability is a big deal, that it's not the end of the world, and that there are positive enabling potential-based things that people need to focus on, and that there are barriers, especially to accessibility, that need to be removed. And so the foundation has an awareness campaign approach to help encourage people to keep it top of mind and to think about what they can do for their attitudes and perhaps engage in their communities nationally or globally to make a difference, hopefully to join us. Mm-hmm. And secondly, we believe, because it's a long journey, we want to really encourage youth across the country and around the world to be part of this. And so we have a school program that really helps teachers teach youth about attitudes, perceptions, barriers, and potential, and build a healthy and inclusive society by following and pursuing our school program. And lastly, the built environment is such a big deal. I mean, it's still hard to believe that in today's world, there are so many buildings that are being built without a real sense of how people with disabilities, the 1 in 5 Canadians, and obviously their families and colleagues and friends, can actually fully participate. And so we're trying to reframe and elevate a global standard that will become the curriculum base for learning for architects, engineers, city planners, and advocates, and building owner and operators. And people will actually have been trained in how to go beyond the minimum code requirements, which are just based on minimum standards, and to actually make a building work for people. And we think that by doing that, and continuing to keep it dynamic, we'll have this global certification program where our seal of approval will be on every major building in the country and in the world. And that will fundamentally transform and accelerate the vision of making the world accessible and inclusive for people with disabilities. So every building where people live, work, learn, and play will be open and inclusive, and will be certified objectively to speak to employees and customers and people who are wanting to be part of the community, that they will know that the thinking and the exercise has been complete, and that there will still be some really cool new ideas that people will be thinking about as things evolve with time and technology and expectations and ideas and innovations.
I imagine over since the Metamotion tour, you've had countless people come up to you and tell you how much the tour inspired them and how much you inspired them. But is it more rewarding to have people come up to you and tell you the things that the foundation has done to help them or change their own lives?
There's just no question that for me, what gives me the most energy that helps me and encourages me to feel like I can continue and giving a sense of satisfaction is to know that someone will say, you know, in Haida Gwaii, someone will come up to me and say, you know, Rick, there is an accessible trail, at Toe Hill, just out of Masset, in the middle of nowhere that you've helped fund so that someone can get access to one of the most beautiful places on earth. Mm-hmm. Or they'll talk about, you know, a playground or someone will, you know, say that, you know, as a result of the work that you've done, and or most importantly, people who are connected to our foundation vision, that thanks to the treatment and support I've received, I'm actually walking again. And so there's really a mosaic of profound practical examples where people have actually benefited. And then there's the other side, which is the more subtle elements where you hear notes or letters of people who have said that they were inspired and or encouraged, or that they were struggling and they thought of a new way to reframe and to try harder and to break through whatever their goals or dreams were, or whatever the barrier was that they were facing, or perhaps they were thinking of in their own way of how to contribute. And our journey became a bit of a metaphor and a catalyst for precipitating something unique. And those are the things I could have never even imagined, because when your head's down and you're pursuing a vision and a mission, you look for the very practical things that reinforce that. But there's the secondary elements just by being human and sharing your story, where people are naturally synapsing and they're building bridges into their own world, and you'll never know where and how the penny will drop.
Mm-hmm. How can people help the foundation?
Well, they can look us up at rickhanson.com, and there's a lot of ways that they can contribute, and we hope that people will, think about us and encourage us. But obviously, people can donate to help our foundation continue to do better work. They can also volunteer, because we need a bigger network of people engaged. They can partner with us if they have an organization that has similar values and objectives. And then they can also work in engaging to perhaps some people might, when we have an offering for a new job position, someone might want to come and come help us be part of the formal team, join our board. And at the end of the day, probably the most important thing is, regardless of all that, they can think about the fact that disability is not always visible. You see the stick man in a wheelchair, signs everywhere and parking stalls and ramps and elevators, but disability affects in many ways all of us. And so we can think about disability as a big deal, and we can interpret or look for ways that we can honor the ability in people, and that we can actually see barriers and be inspired in our own families or our own communities. I mean, just think, if you have a neighbor who has a disability, how can they ever come visit? Or what are the practical things that you can see in your place of work or school or community? Like, is your ballpark accessible for someone with a disability to come and be a coach? Mm-hmm. Or your hockey rink? And it's still stunning to think of how many ballparks and hockey rinks in Canada today are inaccessible for someone to be able to coach, let alone play. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, there's a tremendous amount we can do, but it's consciousness and awareness. And that's the biggest part. And I hope at least people will take the moment to reflect on that and from time to time keep pausing and making connections.
How has COVID impacted the foundation?
you know, it's had a profound impact on the foundation. Obviously, there's been a tremendous focus from government, private sector, and communities on dealing with the emergent issues. We've made sure through our work that we've advocated to governments and key leaders that let's not leave people with disabilities out in this emergency response, because people with disabilities are the most affected segment of our population. Ironically, and unfortunately, they were one of the last groups to be addressed in this process. And I think it gives us a bit of a wake-up call that there's still more to do to keep that top of mind and people understand how big and important it is. We've also been focusing a lot in the transition from our workplace to remote. And so our team has been very resilient and supported by our wonderful CEO, Dormy Yelling, and our board. And they've been encouraged to be able to work their magic from home or in remote locations out of health and respect. And then the third is that we've looked at a lot of our programs and we've transformed a number of our programs to continue to be online and digital. And so, for instance, our accessibility certification program, while it was taught in colleges and universities across the country in a practical classroom setting, during this COVID era, we've just launched an online global program with Athabasca University, the number two global online learning institution. And they've helped us deliver our training online anywhere around the world. And what a powerful accelerator that's been. And our school program itself also has been very much driven to online. But even when classrooms were disrupted, our wonderful team adapted the lesson planning to target it. There were big little lessons that were targeted to parents who were homeschooling or teachers who wanted to drop things off so it could be done at home or in more isolated environments. So the journey can continue. And so I'm super proud of our team for being, again, resilient and adaptive. But it also has had a challenge, you know, that we are just starting to look at, which is, you know, what will this do to the philanthropic market? And, you know, how will Canadians be able to continue to respond to contributing to the not-for-profit world and still, you know, deal with the very critical things that it means to them for their own health, for their families, for their jobs, and the economy at large. And so our foundation will continue to have to be in touch with that and responsive, respectful, but maybe also innovative again to look for alternative ways to still help contribute to make things better and find additional sources of revenue. And so we're currently exploring that. And again, thanks to our wonderful board and team, they're looking at some really cool ideas.
And then just my last question was, what's coming up for the foundation in terms of events or any big things next year as things hopefully return to some form of normal?
Well, we're in the process of our 35th anniversary, and anniversaries give us great milestones for celebration, past, present, and future. And so part of our anniversary process now is obviously connected to the Canadian Museum of History. And I know the museum is looking at opening an exhibit, and we're super excited about that so that people can come personally or be connected virtually to sort of be introduced to the tour, reminded of it, and maybe reconnect to that ongoing journey. We will conclude our 35th anniversary on May the 22nd, and that would be 2022. And so we have milestone moments between now and then that we'll be celebrating. And at the end of the day, most of our celebrations and engagements come from when, as an example, when students and teachers are presented with Difference Maker Awards for the work that they've done, or we've certified buildings across the country that have reached a minimum or a gold level of accessibility. And so we have a whole host of buildings that will be certified as gold
that we really want to profile and highlight, because it's through the innovation and the response of those owner and operators and the community that helps drive them that we think it's important to acknowledge that hard work, but also, you know, share that knowledge and that result to inspire others so we'll accelerate progress to become fully accessible and inclusive.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Rick Hansen, and if you did, please leave a rating and review. You can reach me at craig@canadaehx.ca. You can visit my website, where you'll find hundreds of articles on Canada's history, as well as all my podcast episodes. Just go to canadaehx.ca. And lastly, again, you can support the podcast. Just go to patreon.com/canadaehx. Just like all of these wonderful patrons have. Aaron O'Hara, Robert Dunseith, Todd Casey, Catherine Roy, Luke S., Vic Hedges, J.P. Baer, Jason Hall, Phil Maynard, Spencer M., and Iris Gray. Thanks, and we'll see you again next time.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.